But right now I want to introduce to you Daphne Wisham. She's co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, a fellow at IPS. And Daphne, so thank you so much for making time to come on the air tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Tell our listeners a bit about the group you work with, IPS, and the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. What do you guys work on?
Well, the Institute for Policy Studies has been working on peace, justice, and environmental issues for over four decades, almost five decades. And the project that I founded at the Institute for Policy Studies, called the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, I founded it back in 1996. It's been largely focused on U.S. investments in via taxpayer institutions, taxpayer-backed institutions like the World Bank and the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, in fossil fuels and challenging them on human rights and environmental grounds. And we've been tracking the climate negotiations. I've been tracking them since 1997. I wasn't in Durban. My co-director, Janet Redmond, was. But we've been staying in touch, and it's about 6 hours ahead there, so she was not available to be on your show, as you know, but I'm happy to give you what I know of the negotiations as they're unfolding.
Right, and certainly that's the focus of our discussion. The 17th Conference of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which took place in Durban, South Africa, over this past week and ended just yesterday, Sunday, it got a lot of negative reviews that this gathering of representatives of 200 nations really did not accomplish a lot, and that's disappointing. And I'll just make one other note here that you can also comment on, and that's that the U.S. corporate media really has done their best to ignore this issue, I would say, overall, and this conference in particular. There's really very little news about what happened in Durban.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I hosted a radio show called Earthbeat. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it was on over 60 radio stations in the U.S. and Canada. And one of the reasons I started producing that radio show is I was very frustrated with the quality of media coverage of the climate crisis, which some have suggested is a threat far greater than terrorism and really a threat to the survival of the planet and its species. And unfortunately, we ran out of funding this year, but I think it is really important to continue to try in as many ways as possible to get out the message of this climate crisis, as well as to make clear to people just how low our ambitions are right now, how achievable these emissions cuts that we do need to make are, and that the science is very solid, that even conservative agencies that generally don't speak out on the issue, like the International Energy Agency, have come out with dire warnings suggesting that we're headed towards an 11 degree Fahrenheit or 6 degree centigrade rise by 2100 if given our current emissions trajectory, which is beyond catastrophic. I mean, it's just, it's unthinkable. We're now at 0.8 degrees Celsius, which is about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial greenhouse gas emissions, and we already see the scale of changes. The Arctic is going to be ice-free in a matter of years. We're seeing record, you know, rainfall and flooding and storms and so on. Imagine if this is multiplied by seven times in terms of the temperature rise. And, I mean, it's really hard to imagine what Africa will look like, what parts of the Midwest will look like. I mean, we've had fires raging in Texas this year, flooding in the Northeast, hurricanes almost flooding New York City. This is, it's a fairly grim future that we're looking at if we don't make significant cuts now. Unfortunately, we've also seen a record rise in emissions in the last year, a 6% rise in 1 year, which is pretty much unheard of. That's globally. In the U.S., the good news is that actually U.S. emissions are down U.S. emissions are down by 7% since 2007. And some suggest that we could be going down by 20 or 30% by 2020. And this is largely due not to international treaties, not to cap and trade with offsets, which, of course, the U.S. hasn't participated in the international treaties, and we have not passed climate legislation at the national level. It's due to people power. It's due to people taking on coal-fired power plants, largely coal-fired power plants in their communities, and shutting them down. And the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign is one of the success stories in this. It's also, you know, it's in part due to the economy, but what we're going to be seeing over the coming decade as a result of these coal plants shutting down is a steep decline in U.S. emissions. Now, if we can just begin to expand that people power around the world, and I think that's one of the more hopeful things that comes out of the Durban Summit, is that we did see people acting in solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street protesters. They get it that, you know, it's the 1% that are making the decisions at the international level just as they are at the national level. And there was actually a brief, you know, Occupy Durban, Occupy the Cop going on there. Of course, they got arrested and taken off. But people are beginning to realize that it's up to us to slow these emissions trajectories and curve them downward, and also take on the corporate polluters and the elites that are holding our politics hostage.
Thanks for that, Daphne. And maybe just to bring it back to Durban and specifically what happened there, maybe you could set up for us what was the purpose of the gathering in Durban, South Africa, in this global warming conference? And I know one of the issues is that the Kyoto Protocol is about to expire in several years. But maybe you could tell us what this conference was designed to accomplish and what actually happened or did not happen there.
Well, yeah, you're right. The Kyoto Protocol was it was destined to expire next year in 2012. What was agreed in Durban was that parties to the Kyoto Protocol would decide over the next year on whether or not to extend a second commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol. So that would essentially take us from 2013 till 2017. It was agreed that they would take the next year on making that decision. So essentially what happened is that carbon markets got put on life support for another year, and perhaps at the end of next year they will continue until 2017. Next year, the conference of the parties will meet in the very undemocratic country of Qatar. And there are no commitments to emissions reductions from rich countries in the interim. Basically, what this means is that the Kyoto Protocol is on life support for the next year, and it's being potentially replaced by a new agreement that is even weaker unless we take action and make sure that doesn't happen. The other thing that, you know, people are saying is a breakthrough is that all the parties agreed to legally binding emissions by 2020. Well, it we'll have to see how that plays out. Of course, China and India. China is now the number one greenhouse gas emitter. Their emissions have been rising quite dramatically over the last decade, and India's emissions are also beginning to head up in the upward uptick. But you know, we have to keep in mind that these two countries have over 2 billion people combined and represent, you know, a significant share of the world's population, and they're just now beginning to come online. That doesn't mean they can't begin to develop in a way that avoids making the same mistakes that we have, but they still are experiencing quite significant levels of poverty. And, of course, we're exporting a lot of our coal from places like Wyoming, from the Powder River Basin, to China. In fact, it turns out this part of the country, Wyoming and Montana, where the Powder River Basin, if it were a country, it would be the third largest coal consumer in the world. So we're helping China and India burn lots and lots of coal, and we're culpable in their greenhouse gas emissions.
Daphne, I know one of the other issues that was discussed at the Durban conference was setting up a fund to assist poor nations in adapting to climate change.
Right.
I believe it's called the Green Climate Fund. They're looking for $100 billion a year in public and private financing by 2020. What's the importance of this fund, and how far do they get in really coming to grips with how this would be funded?
Well, the importance of the fund is that it is very critically important, especially for the poorer countries. There are really two major things that should be emerging from these climate negotiations. One is binding emissions reductions, and the other is funding to help the poorer countries adapt to climate change and mitigate climate change as well. Secretary Clinton has committed to $100 billion a year by 2020. She did this in Copenhagen. However, right now what we have is an empty shell. The Green Climate Fund was the structure was agreed to in Durban, and it will be housed at least temporarily at the World Bank, which is something that we are and many others are very opposed to, given the fact that the World Bank is continuing to finance fossil fuels and profiting immensely off of the carbon markets. We think it's a triple conflict of interest for them to then handle the $100 billion a year in climate adaptation and mitigation funds. That's where it is, at least temporarily. We'll see if developing countries succeed in creating some alternative to the World Bank to house the Green Climate Fund in the years to come.
So if you were to assess the successes and failures of this Durban conference, what would you say would be the highlights and lowlights there?
Well, I think the highlights are that we saw people power in force, that we saw youth in particular speaking out boldly at the climate negotiations, risking arrest, standing up for their future. It is, after all, the young people that are going to be paying the highest price around the world. We saw, the beginnings of discussions that absolutely do need to take place between all of the countries globally, and, as some of the small island states rightfully say to India and China, you want the right to develop, we want the right just to survive, and clearly survival trumps development. So we're beginning to have the discussion that's a fairly difficult one involving some of the larger emitting developing countries as well as the poorer ones, and that's at least a step in the right direction. The problem is that the U.S., once again, is not only not joining the Kyoto Protocol in any meaningful way, they've refused to put any money on the table. They refused to agree to any binding emissions cuts. They've even refused to support something called the Financial Transactions Tax, which could potentially raise $600 billion a year while also curbing financial speculation, which is something that all of us are beginning to learn a lot more about in the aftermath of this meltdown that we're living through, of, in part as a result of financial speculation. On the one hand, the Obama administration has to some degree had its hands tied at the national level by the Senate, by the fact that we have a Senate that will not even consider climate legislation, and some senators who think that climate change doesn't even exist. The Obama administration gets some sympathy on that level, but it gets no sympathy for actively trying to obstruct some of the talks that were going on at the international level. We kept hearing that Obama's negotiators were playing a negative role in obstructing progress at the international level, and that is absolutely shameful.
How How do you explain the Obama administration's negative role here, as charged by some critics, given that he campaigned very strongly on green energy and a strong environmental stand when he was running for president in 2008?
You know, Obama is a puzzle. You know, on the one hand, he did take at least somewhat of a principled stand, not complete opposition to the tar sands pipeline, which you know, he delayed a decision and wants a full environmental review and seems to be, you know, holding firm on that despite Republicans' attempts to link it to a payroll tax decrease, payroll tax legislation on Capitol Hill. He's also been pushing for, as you've mentioned, some renewable energy initiatives domestically. He's supported stronger fuel efficiency standards in automobiles. All of these things are actually making a difference and are beginning to send the right kinds of signals to investors and policymakers and others that we are serious about some of these emissions reductions. So it is puzzling to me why the Obama administration negotiators were so hostile to progress at the international level. You know, cynically, one could say, well, it's evidence of the 1% and the elite sort of basically acting as the puppeteers at the international level. Certainly, you see a huge role for the Chamber of Commerce and their lobbyists at the international level at these climate conferences. I've been going to them long enough to remember when it was just a few sort of nerdy scientists and climate geeks who would go to these conferences, and now it's like it's just overrun like a trade show by people buying and selling their, you know, carbon markets ideas and various oil companies claiming that they have the solution, coal companies pushing carbon capture and storage technology, and all of the sort of business-as-usual industries trying to make sure they maintain their profitable margins. And I'm sure that the U.S. lobbyists, that the Obama administration is not immune to these lobbyists at the international level. However, it is alarming that they have been called out at the international level by quite a few countries, and ironically, in these negotiations, they were trying to pin the blame on India, whose per capita emissions are far below China's as well as ours, and claiming that India was the problem. Thankfully, that didn't go very far. India does burn quite a bit of coal, but India has not been trying to obstruct negotiations the way the U.S. has for over a decade.
We're speaking with Daphne Wisham. She is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-director of the group's Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. And Daphne, just a quick question or get your observation on this. It wasn't all that long ago that many Republican and conservative politicians were on board the whole idea of the need to take action on global warming internationally. But that has turned around dramatically, where you have most Republican politicians and certainly almost all those running for president in next year's election posing as climate change deniers. Even have the video recording of Newt Gingrich, who's now the front runner in the GOP race, according to polls, making a video tape with former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi advocating that their action be taken on global warming. You have this complete turnaround, and I always wonder, you know, do these politicians have children they care about, given the overwhelming scientific evidence that there is global warming and it will cause, natural phenomenon that will hurt, you know, everything from people's exposure to extreme weather, to agriculture, to so many negative effects. And I wonder how they weigh the future of their kids against whatever check they're drawing from ExxonMobil and do their campaign coffers. I just don't understand what's going on. And I know you've probably given it some thought.
Well, I mean, I think the Koch brothers and their billionaire Koch brothers, who are also part of the tar sands conglomeration, they've been part of the climate denial machine. They've been funding the Tea Party. They've been funding a lot of these folks who are running for office, who basically, as a condition of running, they've got to speak from the same sing from the same songbook as the Koch brothers and deny that climate change exists. And of course, that works very well for the Koch brothers. If they can continue to deny climate science, they can continue to build as many pipelines from the tar sands as people will permit. That's the bad news. The good news is that regardless of all of this, climate science denial that's coming out of the U.S. and perhaps some other countries as well, the world passed the $1 trillion mark in clean energy investment since 2004. So we've seen just in the last 7 years $1 trillion in solar and wind and smart meters and grids and so on. We're beginning to see, the people that actually are paying attention to where the money is going to be made in the future, realizing that the smart money is on clean energy, and there's significant growth happening there. So I think these guys are literally, they're dinosaurs. They're using energy from the dinosaurs, and they're speaking like dinosaurs. And their time has come, and I think the future will be clean. It's just a question of how much damage we'll do in the interim, and hopefully, people can take heart and know that people power really is making a difference in this country, and we've just got to keep it up.
The scary part, of course, is that many scientists and people in the know compare it to turning around a huge oil tanker on the ocean. It's going to take a long, long time to turn around the effects of global warming, even if we start in a concerted way right now, which we're not. Mm-hmm. So that's frightening. But Daphne, before you go, I wanted to just get your practical advice for our listeners. What would you advise listeners who are concerned about global warming? How could they best apply their time and energy on this issue to push our economic and political system to respond to global warming in a very constructive way?
Well, as I've been saying, I really feel that the action is not happening in Washington, that our elected officials are in the pocket of the oil, gas, coal, and tar sands industries. And the way to move forward, and it's clearly resulting in emissions decreases, you can read Lester Brown's Plan B update from November 2nd of this year, and you'll see all of the facts and figures. But he clearly documents how greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. are going down. Largely, the biggest and most dominant force is the anti-coal campaign that is in part coordinated by the Sierra Club and involving hundreds of local groups that oppose coal because of its effects on human health. And, I think we're going to see the same sort of strategy being used in the fracking debate, where people are going to be challenging the human health impacts of all the chemicals that are being injected into the groundwater in the process of getting at the natural gas. Human health is a uniter. It's not a divider. Climate change right now, for whatever reason, tends to divide people, but everybody cares about their health and the health of their communities. So that plus, keeping the pressure on and making the personal choices as well, getting, driving less, using fuel-efficient transport or public transport, opting for clean energy whenever you can, and working in ways with our own investments to try to invest in clean energy alternatives. And, the more we do this collectively, the more we will benefit in more ways than one, I think financially as well as in terms of the health for ourselves and our children.
Well, Daphne, thanks for being here tonight and, you know, really getting into some of the details and major issues concerning the recently concluded Durban Climate Change Conference. And do leave our listeners, as we say goodnight, with the web address for your group at IPS if they want to get more information and ideas.
It's ips-dc.org, and we've got a wealth of information up there also on our work on the in support of the Occupy Wall Street folks and addressing many issues on environment and the war and other issues. So take a look. It's a rich resource.
That's ips-dc.org. And I know one of the groups that's spearheading a lot of direct action these days around the Keystone XL pipeline is 350.org, 350.org is another good place.
And Tar Sands Action is sort of the umbrella for a lot of that work.
Excellent. Well, thanks for your time tonight, Daphne, and all your important work, and we'll look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Good night. That's Daphne Wisham, co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies, Sustainable Energy and Economy Network.